Hi, I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton, and this is Your Health, the weekly podcast from NPR's Science Desk.
This week, we'll learn why some lucky people seem to stay healthy when everyone around them is sick. And we'll look closer, but not too close, at why sneezing is good for me and bad for you.
We'll also catch up on Michelle Obama's anti-obesity campaign. Some people think she's reaching a little too far into people's lives, and they don't like it.
And we'll talk with our healthy resident health blogger, Scott Hensley, about things you smoke and things you eat and things that try to make you sleep.
But first, NPR correspondent Dick Knox is here with us in the studio in Washington to talk about a big change in the treatment of breast cancer for some women. Actually, quite a lot of women, right, Dick? Hey.
That's right, yeah.
Hi, Dick.
Hi, April. Hi, Rebecca.
So what is this change all about, and tell us why it's so important?
Well, for a long time, the usual practice when a woman is diagnosed with an early stage of breast cancer is that surgeons would inject some dye when she's having the original surgery, like to take the lump out, and the dye would go to a nearby lymph node, and they would take out that lymph node, or maybe a couple of them, and see if there were any cancer cells in the lymph node. If there were, they would go further and remove a bunch of lymph nodes from under her arm.
Sounds painful.
Yeah, it has lasting problems for a lot of women because they get swollen. It can be chronically painful. They can lose sensation. They can lose the use of their arm. So a new study has challenged that and says that you don't necessarily need to have the lymph nodes in that area removed, even if one of them shows to be positive for cancer cells.
How come? Why not?
Well, it's very interesting. It's kind of counterintuitive because, you know, they thought back in the mid-90s that it made perfect sense that if you found one of these so-called sentinel lymph nodes that was positive, then you should, you know, that means a cancer spread, so you should cut out the other lymph nodes in the area to prevent the cancer from spreading further.
Mm-hmm.
You know, makes sense. But in fact, this change has happened over the last 15 years or so in cancer treatment. Women are getting diagnosed earlier. And once they're diagnosed, more women are getting chemotherapy after they have the lumpectomy, and they're getting radiation to that area, to the breast, and maybe a little bit to the armpit. And so it seems as though the newer kinds of treatment really take care of the problem. You don't have to cut out the lymph nodes.
So just radiation therapy and chemotherapy without taking it out seems to be working.
Yeah, they seem to be mopping up the cells that are outside the breast. So they're saying, now we know you don't have to do the lymph node surgery, even if you find a positive sentinel node.
And which group of cancer patients are we talking about? Which stages?
It's not everybody. It's the women who have stage 1 or 2 breast cancer, which means that the original so-called primary tumor is pretty small. And they have chemotherapy afterwards, and they have radiotherapy afterwards. So this is about, estimates are like 20% of women with new breast cancer diagnoses this year. That's a lot of women because mm-hmm. there's so many women with breast cancer. So it's, you know, tens of thousands of women.
So this sounds potentially like a good thing, a good change in treatment.
It's a good change. And one other interesting thing about the study is that they found that more than 90% of women in each group, the ones who had conventional treatment, the ones who had didn't have the lymph node dissection, survived 5 years or so. And that was much higher than they were expecting. They were expecting maybe 80% five-year survival. So that just shows that overall survival for all newly diagnosed early-stage breast cancers have really improved in recent years.
Hmm. That's great. You know, you also reported on another important medical procedure this week. It's also good news. Surgery done on fetuses while they are still in the womb to reduce or even eliminate the paralysis and brain damage of spina bifida.
That's right, and it really is pretty amazing. Researchers have shown that an incredibly delicate and risky and controversial operation can save many children from the worst effects of severe spina bifida.
What's spina bifida again, Dick?
There are about 1,500 babies born every year in this country with mm-hmm. severe spina bifida. It's a fairly common birth defect. It's called a neural tube defect. And basically, it's a hole in the spine of the developing fetus.
Mm.
And in the worst cases, as in this study, a loop of the baby's spine actually comes out and you know, sort of flapping around in the amniotic fluid, and that damages it during pregnancy. And these kids end up with paralysis and often with buildup of fluid in the brain and brain damage. So the study looked at 183 pregnancies in which the fetus had been diagnosed by routine ultrasound, you know, about the 19th, 20th week of pregnancy, to have spina bifida. The study randomly assigned half the pregnancies to have this new surgery, which is done before birth. And then the other half had the traditional treatment, which is the operation that's done only after the baby's born. It turns out the fetuses who had the surgery before birth were more likely to walk by themselves later, about twice as likely. And even more important, the doctors say, fetal surgery can prevent the buildup of fluid in the brain. That's a really serious problem because it can cause devastating lifelong brain damage. I talked to Dr. Diana Farmer, who helped lead the study.
This is the first time that fetal surgery has ever been attempted and validated for what we think of as a non-fatal birth defect.
Farmer is chief of pediatric surgery at the University of California, San Francisco. She says there's been a lot of debate about the ethics of fetal surgery.
Prior to this, because of the risk to the mother, we only considered fetal surgery in a circumstance where either the fetus would not survive pregnancy or whether the baby would be likely to die soon after birth.
The surgery has to be done before the 26th week of pregnancy. At that point, the fetus is only about 4 inches long.
It's important to remember that this is not a walk in the park.
Surgeons make a 3-inch incision in the mother's uterus, exposing the fetus. They position the fetus so they can see the spinal defect. It's a small hole through which a loop of the naked spinal cord protrudes.
I'd say it's maybe the size of between a raisin and an almond.
They carefully put the tiny spinal cord back where it's supposed to be, cover it with layers of membranes and muscle, and hope for the best. One of the drawbacks is that mothers who've had the operation often deliver their babies several weeks early, posing additional risks. But the study found no more babies died after they got prenatal surgery than those who got the operation as usual, after birth. 2 infants died in each group. Many of the infants who had the prenatal operation still had problems, but significantly fewer than the babies who got surgery after they were born.
Spina bifida is not cured by this procedure. Not every patient was helped. What it does is give a chance at improving the outcome.
Tara Hallman of Pennsburg, Pennsylvania, knows what that means. She had the fetal operation at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She recalls the day when she and her husband, Jake, saw the ultrasound picture that revealed spina bifida in their son, Brett.
It was immediately obvious, even to my husband and I. There was a gaping hole in the back of Brett's back.
A few days later, surgeons were telling them about the risks and potential benefits of fetal surgery.
We had to sign paperwork, and it basically said we might lose the baby in the surgery, and we might lose the mom.
The gamble paid off when Brett smiled, sat up, and crawled on schedule.
When he walked at 17 months without any braces, without anything, it just took my breath away. I'll never forget the day that I saw him taking his steps. It was really exciting.
Surgeon Scott Adzik says today Brett Hallman is a lively first grader who enjoys swimming and other sports.
He's doing very, very well, although he's not completely normal. He does have some bowel and bladder issues.
But nothing that can't be managed. For instance, he can't urinate normally, so the 7-year-old has learned to insert a catheter every few hours. His mom says he has to work harder to keep up physically, but he hasn't let it get him down.
Everybody has their challenges in life, and everyone has their battle scars, as we call them, and this is his, and it's something that he's actually very proud of. He loves to show people his scar.
She says Brett just sees spina bifida as part of his identity. Richard Knox, NPR News.
And now we're joined by our harried health blogger, Scott Hensley. Hey, Scott.
Guilty as charged. Here I am.
And well, harried, yes.
Glad you could make it.
Nice to see you.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
So, pot is always one of your most popular posts. What'd you write about marijuana this week?
There was a fascinating analysis in a psychiatry journal that looked at all the literature on whether smoking marijuana was linked to earlier development of psychosis, schizophrenia, things like that. And the bottom line was, yes, it was, by about 2 years.
Isn't that because people tend to self-medicate if they have mental problems?
I wondered the same thing and didn't trust my own judgment in reading the paper, so I talked with the head of the mental health department at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health to ask him, you're the expert, read this paper over and tell me what you think. He said that it was a very important paper and that it did a lot to synthesize and consolidate the literature. There are alternate explanations out there about what could be happening, whether it's truly causal, whether it's self-medication, whether we have people who are vulnerable to having this problem and then the use of marijuana tips them over. It's not really strong enough to say causality, but it doesn't appear that it's just self-medication either, because alcohol, for instance, which you would think would also advance things, didn't have the same kind of effect. So
Was this group of people that they were looking at, those who are already having some signs of mental illness? Is this a general population?
What they did was they looked at all the studies they could find that were out there, and they ended up settling on more than 80 already published studies, and then taking those data and smashing them together, essentially, but in a legitimate way, to try and see whether there was a bigger conclusion that they could draw from the body of all this work put together. So it wasn't a prospective study where they followed people over time. It wasn't an individual study where they looked at particular patients. They were looking at the scientific literature to try and make sense out of it. Bottom line, I said, well, what do you do with this? I asked the guy at Hopkins, and he said, well, there's an important thing here. 2 years or 3 years, it was actually 2.7 years that it moved up the psychosis symptoms, could be incredibly important in a person's life. The difference between somebody having this kind of serious mental health problem when they're 20 versus 23 or 18 versus 21 is huge. You know, if somebody's completely, the example the guy gave me, William Eaton, was if somebody had completed college before this hit them, it would make a huge difference than if they were still in school or hadn't yet started school. Their prognosis is much better. And so he said to parents, he said, look, if you're concerned about this, he said, you know, I would be worried as a parent if I had a child who was showing some of the signs that can kind of go in that direction, being a real loner, having, you know, rather strange flights of fancy, not little ones, but bigger ones. That's the kind of person you should really be careful about smoking pot. And that was his message.
Another post you did that I think shows the need for some caution was this video that you put up of this guy who kind of looks like Santa Claus lecturing us about all these natural remedies that we can buy everywhere in Walgreens and CVS and the supermarkets.
Homeopathic, specifically.
That's right. Homeopathic remedies. And did a couple of posts this week that seemed to really hit a nerve. And the reason for them was last weekend, a group of skeptics in England helped organize the second worldwide homeopathic medicine overdose. And homeopathy is this... it's not herbs. That's a different thing. Some people, it's an
like
alternative medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, herbs herbs are one thing. This is where a substance is diluted and diluted and diluted and diluted until the actual medicine, the vial or the pill, may have like an atom or not even an atom of this stuff in it anymore. And then the theory of the adherence to homeopathy is that this can then spur the body to heal itself or avoid the or take care of the symptoms.
But it's just like drinking a bunch of water.
Debate about that.
Right. Well, this is in fact why these skeptics said, well, look, if this stuff is so potent, then let's just drink it like crazy. And if it does something, maybe we'll show the effects. Now, of course, their belief is that it won't do anything.
I just want to interrupt you because we're going to hear a clip from the video that you have embedded in your post.
Oh, great.
Right? And basically the description is the guy, he's standing on what looks like a ship in the middle of the Arctic or the Antarctic.
He's off the Antarctic.
Off the Antarctic,
just
yeah.
To show that they would go to the ends of the earth. They had people everywhere doing this. I looked at a bunch of the videos, and I thought this one really stood out because it was one guy in an amazing setting, and he's pretty colorful. So let's hear it.
Welcome to beautiful Antarctica as part of the 1023 International Homeopathic Overdose Challenge. I've chosen a sleep and insomnia preparation. I have on hand here the ship's doctor. This is Giles, and he has the defibrillator just in case something goes wrong. But in the spirit of the occasion, we won't plug it in. So it'll be a homeopathic defibrillator working on the principles of the memory of once having had an electrical discharge. It does say one spray under the tongue before half an hour before going to bed. So we'll just see how much of this bottle I can get through before I fall asleep. Well, it's been 3 hours since I've overdosed on the homeopathic remedy. So far, no effects whatsoever, not feeling sleepy. Am I okay, Doc?
Boringly bloody normal.
Boringly bloody normal. And by the way, that bottle of water with a little bit of ethanol in it costs $30. Someone is making a big profit out of woo-woo.
When I contacted the people at the Merseyside group, they told me that more than 1,600 people around the world, I think it was 28 countries plus Antarctica, took part in this mass overdose, and there were no reports of injuries, deaths, or any other problem. There's another post about a challenge that the magician and now professional skeptic James Randi threw out there.
Santa Claus looking guy.
Yeah, the Santa Claus looking guy. He'll pay $1 million to a company, a maker of homeopathy remedies, homeopathic remedies, that will agree to go forward with a study to prove that they don't work, and he's confident that they don't
work.
Like
a clinical trial, like a real study.
Like a real solid clinical study. Mm-hmm. So those were the two posts.
Okay, so then you had another post about baby formula and childhood obesity. This was kind of interesting because a few weeks ago, one of our reporters, Patty Naiman, did a story about early weight gain in infants and the kind of formula that you give your baby. And this one is about the timing of solid foods in infancy, right?
Right. And the summary for this is parents, don't start kids on solid food before they're at least 4 months. This study confirms that. It found a real difference for kids who were formula fed. Didn't show up so much in the kids who are breastfed. But the take-home message is don't start that solid food too early. It can contribute to obesity by the time they're ready for preschool.
So the kids more likely to be obese by age 3 had formula and started solid foods early. And the kids who were breastfed and started solids early didn't have the same tendency for obesity.
It's a double-barrel message, in a sense, which is go along with the advice about not starting solid food so early. It's, you know, another example where the breastfeeding looked better than formula feeding.
So don't start solid foods early, especially if the babies have been on formula.
Absolutely.
Scott, thank you very much, and we will talk to you again next week.
See ya.
Bye.
First Lady Michelle Obama has spent the last year working on an initiative called Let's Move, which is aimed squarely at ending childhood obesity within a generation. Well, this past week, it's been a one-year anniversary, so NPR's Ari Shapiro took a look at how much progress she's made.
The idea of a sustained project for the First Lady started in the early 1960s.
It was Jacqueline Kennedy's work on refurbishing the White House, and that sort of set a bar early on.
Dr. Myra Gutten of Rider University in New Jersey studies the history of first ladies.
First ladies generally are dealing with less controversial or uncontroversial issues, but those which tend to benefit many people in the country.
Lady Bird Johnson focused on highway beautification. Rosalind Carter addressed mental health. Barbara Bush took on literacy, and in that respect, Gutten says the Let's Move initiative is right in line with what others have done. But she says Michelle Obama goes farther than her predecessors.
She has partners from Major League Baseball to Walmart, and no other First Lady initiative that I can think of had that kind of support from the corporate world.
I am thrilled about Walmart's new nutrition charter.
Last month, the First Lady joined Walmart executives to announce that the grocery chain will reduce sugar, sodium, and trans fats in thousands of its products. The month before that, she persuaded Congress to pass a $4.5 billion child nutrition bill. At the signing ceremony, the president credited his wife with giving the bill the urgency it needed to become a law.
Had I not been able to get this passed, I would be sleeping on the couch.
Dr. Marion Nessel is a professor of nutrition, food studies, and public health at NYU. She says the First Lady has moved what used to be a niche movement into the mainstream.
There's no question that there are enormous changes taking place in school lunches. You can see that all over the country, where schools everywhere are trying to do something to improve the quality of the food that they're serving to children. So this is having an immediate impact.
The First Lady rarely misses an opportunity to plug this program. Guests who are invited to the White House for a meal will often read that ingredients on the menu come from the White House garden. Even the president's Super Bowl party, on top of the kielbasa and buffalo wings, included White House honey ale. Yesterday, Mrs. Obama held conference calls to thank mayors, school officials, and medical professionals who have been involved in the program.
It's pretty amazing, for me at least, to look back and see how far we've come.
Surgeon General Regina Benjamin said there is no greater challenge to the country's health than obesity.
Since 1980, obesity rates have doubled in adults and more than tripled in children. And the problem is even worse among Black, Hispanic, and Native American children.
It helps that kids' nutrition has historically been a bipartisan issue. 5 years ago, Democrat Bill Clinton and Republican Mike Huckabee teamed up on a childhood obesity program. Now that the White House is steering the ship, some Republicans have jumped overboard. Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, and Sarah Palin have all attacked Mrs. Obama's program directly.
Instead of a government thinking that they need to take over, make decisions for us according to some politician or politician's wife priorities, just leave us alone, get off our back.
During the Super Bowl telecast, viewers in Washington, D.C. saw an ad against a proposed soda tax that struck a similar tone without mentioning Mrs. Obama's program specifically.
Give me a break. I can decide what to buy without government help. The government is just getting too involved in our personal lives.
While the critics accuse the program of being too heavy-handed, many of these changes come from agreements rather than regulations. No surprise, the First Lady favors carrots over sticks, and also carrots over Twinkies. Now that her team has made advances getting healthier foods into public schools and grocery stores, they are working on the next frontier, more nutritious options in restaurants. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, the White House.
It is I, Captain Vegetable, with my carrot and my celery. Eating crunchy vegetables is good for me, and they're good for you, so eat them too, for teeth so strong your whole life long. Eat celery and carrots by the bunch. Three cheers for me, Captain Vegetable! Crunch, crunch, crunch!
Well, if we're all in the same place at the same time and there's cold germs around, why does one of us get sick and
you.
Not the other?
Me.
You. NPR's Patty Naiman went looking for the answer.
If you ask around, you'll probably find everybody's got a story like this. Here's mine. Recently, my mother and I flew across country. A few days later, I got a really bad cold. My 85-year-old mother didn't. I'm not the only one who'll tell you that it just seems unfair who gets colds and who doesn't. My colleague Jane Greenhalgh got really sick last winter. So did her children, but not her husband Tom.
If there's a cold going around, the kids get it, I get it, Tom never gets it. It's a bit irritating, actually.
And studies show this kind of experience is really common. Dr. Greg Poland of the Mayo Clinic says his wife has never spent a day in bed.
We'll be sick, you know, we'll be moaning and groaning, and I'll be sick in bed with a little bell to call her because I'm so weak and can't get up, and she's just never ill.
Poland's a cold expert, and he told us genes have a lot to do with who gets sick.
Jane, you're married to Superman, and I got Superwoman. I think what we're going to find as the years go by is that Tom has a set of genes that together basically form an immunologic barrier for him against many of these common viruses.
But what about me and my mother on the airplane? I figured that at 85 she was more fragile and therefore more susceptible to getting sick. I figured wrong. As Dr. Poland says, her age was probably her secret weapon.
Your mother, who's older than you, has undoubtedly seen many more of these sorts of respiratory viruses than you and may well have encountered that one sometime in her previous 70, 80 years and hence has some level of immunity to it.
Once exposed, most people have lifelong immunity, but only to that one particular virus. And there are hundreds of different cold viruses. And here's where total chance comes in. If you happen to be in the line of fire of even one sneeze or a cough, the cold viruses can get you.
Millions. There's millions and millions of them.
And if you're not already immune, like my mother probably was, and if you're sitting in a narrow airplane seat like I was, sharing an armrest with your neighbor, you're even more at risk because cold viruses not only travel through the air, they travel when you touch another person or even an object.
Maybe I get up to go to the bathroom and you didn't, but the guy who went to the bathroom right before me has a cold, sneezed into his hand, grabbed the doorknob, and then I come right behind him and grab it.
So a combination of genetics, immunity, and exposure all determine whether or not we get sick. And sometimes we make it really easy for cold germs to get us. Take public gatherings, for example, like theater or church.
Take your eyes off the speaker for a moment and look at the people around you. What you'll find is that about every minute or two, people have their hand on their face. A number of them have their fingers in their nose. A number of them will sneeze or cough into their hand. And then what they'll do is turn and extend their hand to you.
Dr. Poland calls this a lack of respiratory etiquette. Figuring out how to stop the chain of infection is something lots of researchers want to do. Infectious disease specialist John Traynor of the University of Rochester calls it the million-dollar question.
Why is it that some people get sick and some people don't?
Traynor says once scientists get the answer to that question, once they figure out exactly how cold viruses cause infection and how some people's immune systems keep them healthy, then science will really be able to fight the common cold.
One great outcome of really understanding why some people get sick is to develop medicines or vaccines that would target those mechanisms and effectively prevent respiratory illnesses or treat them.
A great step forward, especially when you consider the average person spends about 1 year of their life in bed sick with a cold. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
And now let's take a closer look at the sneeze. NPR's Nancy Shoot reports that it does a lot more than just spread germs.
We all know that sneezing spreads cold viruses, but does it do any good for the person who's sneezing? Indeed, it does. The sneeze is the body's first line of defense against alien invaders, the kind that make us sick. Eli Meltzer is an allergist in San Diego. He says that germs, dust, and pollen that make their way into the nose are no match for the mighty sneeze.
It's powerful. We actually blow out the sneeze at 40 miles an hour. The discharge can go 20 feet, and it's said that 40,000 droplets can come out when you spritz with the mouth and the nose in a sneeze.
And you don't have to be in great shape to rock a powerful sneeze. That's because we sneeze pretty much on autopilot. When the nerve cells inside of the nose detect an intruder, it starts an itch. That sends a signal to the brain.
The signal to the brain causes a reflex, and that reflex goes to the face and the throat and the chest, and the person takes a deep breath because of that, and then they explode this air from their lungs through their mouth and nose.
But for many people, sneezing doesn't end their misery. Once people have a cold, sneezing is just one more symptom.
The composite of those symptoms, the itching, sneezing, runny, stuffy, makes people miserable.
And for people with allergies, sneezing can be a long-term problem.
It makes them miserable not just for a day or a moment, but often for months and years.
Also, some people sneeze when they're not sick. They sneeze when they're exposed to sunlight. Louis Potacek is a neurologist at the University of California in San Francisco. He studies epilepsy and movement disorders. He studied this sneeze reflex for clues on how genes affect the brain and nervous system.
Photic sneeze is clearly not a disease. It looks like it's genetic. It probably affects 10% of the population.
Those strange sneezers aren't alone. Other people sneeze when they eat too much or when they eat certain foods, like mints. When we asked people in NPR, we found a lot of these sneezers.
These are the wintergreens spitting out of our vending machine.
Producer Giselle Grayson says she sneezes every time she eats mints.
Here's it right away. I think the performance anxiety is killing me. Maybe I should go buy some Altoids.
Okay, no luck there. But the music desk is Sneeze City. Stephen Thompson says mints and chocolate are a sure thing. He tries chewing minty gum.
Oh, I don't know. This. I got nothing. And this, seriously, mint and chocolate, always.
So, the mints didn't work for Steven either.
You know, you could do a scientific study on people's inability to sneeze on demand.
Bob Boylan is one of those guys who sneezes in sunlight. We put him right by the window on a sunny day.
Almost. But I definitely feel inside, like, all the, those tingly things that happen just before you sneeze. Oh, what a letdown.
Our experiment may have failed because of a basic rule of science. Observation affects the outcome of experiments. Louis Potacek of UCSF told us one way we might have overcome that problem.
I would be willing to bet a lot of money that if you took those people and you put them in a really dark room for 2 hours and then walked out into bright, bright sunlight, they'd have a much, much higher likelihood of sneezing and couldn't be suppressed by feeling self-conscious.
Potacek said he'd love to be able to study these light sneezers because they might give him clues into how our eyes talk to our brains. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
I've been aching to sneeze, begging please, pretty please, but I can't get the thing to come out.
And that's all for your health. I'm April Fulton.
And I'm Rebecca Davis. Thanks to Richard Knox for stopping by today. We had production assistance from Adam Cole.
And our blogger is Scott Hensley. You can check out our health blog shots at npr.org/shots. See you next week.
And thanks for listening.
I've been waking at dawn with a fever going on and a stain that just won't wash away. I've got nothing to hide, just something inside keeps coming back day after day. Come on out, my pretty baby. Relieve me.